Martinez, please go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the court. There is no alleged new evidence in this case that places doubt in the integrity of the jury's verdict, convicting this defendant of armed robbery and felony murders. The information in the Red Report regarding Moti answering a page from police is not the type of evidence that would probably change the jury's verdict under prong 3 of the Carter test. It is simply not the type of evidence that has the power to alter the verdict. Why? Because even if the jury heard Moti answered a page from police to a number found in the victim's pocket hours after the crimes were committed, there is no evidence in this report that says Moti contacted the victims on the night of the murders or that the victims contacted him. So when defendant claims this report is the link to admit Mary Jones's testimony, this alleged link is non-existent or attenuated at best. It is simply evidence of a drug supplier having the number to one of his drug dealers. There's also no evidence of Moti being present at the crime scene at all, other than defendant's first time claim and sudden recollection in front of the jury. Not even Mary Jones's own testimony says Moti was at the crime scene. When asked why her son believed the police may have his name and pager number, she says several different things to the court. He had made arrangements, he had met with, he had beeped them, and they're supposed to bring drugs for him. When later asked, do you know when he beeped them? No, I think I don't know. Her testimony is problematic on many levels, and it would have been irrelevant, misleading, and confusing to the jury. And it was inadmissible hearsay that would not come in under the statement against interest exception, because there were no statements by Thomas where he inculpates himself in the crimes. Importantly, the evidence in the Red Report did not negate defendant's own culpability in the armed robbery and felony murders. The state only had to prove that a murder was committed while defendant, acting either alone or with others, was engaged in the commission of or attempt to commit or flight after committing or attempting to commit a robbery, for the jury to find defendant guilty or both of both armed robbery and the felony murders. So the jury heard how defendant lured the victims to Jersey City from Brooklyn, how he recruited his co-defendant to participate, how he obtained the guns, took the drugs from Salazar, pointed a gun at him while he pleaded for his life, shot and killed him in cold blood. They heard how defendant gave the guns to his co-defendant to discard, how co-defendant in turn gave them to his brother, who, while telling him that he and the defendant just killed two Puerto Ricans. They heard how defendant went to his girlfriend's house immediately after, confessed to killing one of the victims, and his concern, his fingerprints were left in the vehicle. And most significant, the jury also heard from defendant himself. They heard his inconsistent statements where he denied planning the meeting the night of the crimes, when his attorney had already conceded that in his opening statement, since that is what defendant told the police initially. Again, they heard for the very first time from defendant that Moti was at the crime scene, when defendant had previously told police that his co-defendant was the sole killer who used two different guns. They heard defendant claim he was only at the crime scene acting as a bodyguard, but crossed the street to speak to a woman for 10 minutes while the drug deal was taking place. And they heard that he did not carry a gun as a bodyguard, but used kung fu to protect himself and others. The jury did not believe a single word defendant said. So although they were not firmly convinced defendant shot the driver, they were certainly firmly convinced he helped plan and participate in the armed robbery, which led to the felony murders. And even if the jury heard that Moti answered a page from police hours after the crimes, any belief by the jury that a third person may have also been present did not negate the evidence against defendant's independent participation in planning of the crimes. That is why, even if combined with Mary Jones's hearsay testimony, this evidence would not have placed doubt in the integrity of the jury's verdict. For these same reasons, if the court decided that defendant's ineffective assistance of counsel claims were not time barred under Rule 322.5, as argued fully in the state's brief, and that the court can consider them at this time, those claims also fail under both prongs of the Strickland test, because defendant has not proved by a preponderance of the credible evidence that trial counsel was deficient and that the alleged deficiency prejudiced his right to a fair trial, meaning that but for counsel's alleged deficiency, the result of the trial would have been different. Therefore, whether defendant argues he's entitled to a new trial under the theory of newly discovered evidence or ineffective assistance of counsel, both arguments fail and a new trial should be denied. Thank you.
Ms. Martinez, the thrust of the defendant's presentation now is that Ms. Jones would have gotten on the stand and said the defendant was set up, that the defendant was made to bear the weight for something he didn't do. Surely that's a statement against interest on the part of Thomas if he's admitting to corrupting the administration of justice by setting someone up falsely. No?
The context of that conversation between Thomas and his mother with regard to the setup that he claimed, that she claims he said set up, he was calling from the homicide detectives from the actual headquarters. So he told his mother, I'm here, I'm cooperating with police. They're going, you know, I'm helping them set him up, and I'm actually going to, your phone's going to get tapped. They're going to call, they're going to tap into your phone whenever he calls, keep him on the line. That was the full conversation, the full context of the conversation that she alleges happened between them. So in that context, the setup doesn't mean he's trying to frame Thomas, but that he is cooperating with police fully.
So this is the language from page 38. Maurice sure. said, Rab would have to take the weight. In order to get Rab off his back, Rab would have to be gotten rid of. Isn't that a statement against interest?
I'm not sure how that is a statement against interest, Your Honor. If in what Ms. Jones testified to was that her son had been involved in some kind of drug deal where he stole money from the defendant, and that he somehow wanted to make sure that he went to jail, but not because he was part of these, that he was part of the commission of the crimes of the murders on June 6, 1993, but because there had been a prior issue between him and Hannah.
So your understanding of these passages is that he's just explaining that he's going to reveal information and cooperate truthfully.
That's correct. He does cooperate. He does, you know, have two conversations with LaQue. He sets up LaQue. He tries to get information out of LaQue to see where the guns are hidden. He tries to set up LaQue, or he does effectively set up LaQue so that police know where he is so that they can go arrest him, and they do arrest him because of Maurice Thomas.
So let's look at, you had referenced page 29. This is going to the theory of a declaration against interest. You have the transcript?
This is the transcript of Jones's testimony.
Yeah.
Yes, I have it in
front of me. And she's now quoting her son, Ma. This kid LaQue have just killed two drug suppliers, and I don't know what to do because I think the police have my name. I mean, have my name and my beeper number. Now, further down, she's testifying. He made arrangements. He had beeped them, and they were supposed to bring drugs for him. And the court, beep who? And this is the witness Mary Jones. Right. Maurice had beeped the drug suppliers. This is on the same page when they're talking about the killing of the two drug suppliers, right?
Yes.
We have that?
I do have that. And then
you don't, so that.
They asked her, do you know when he beat them? And she says, no, I think, okay. I don't know.
Okay, so now let's take that in the context with the Red report.
Sure.
Okay, Lieutenant Red is at the crime scene. He takes from Salazar, who's in the front seat of the car, a bloody piece of paper with the pager number, and Red calls the pager number, and who responds? Thomas. Thomas responds, correct?
Yes.
Am I correct about that?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. There's something else about the Red report I'd like to point out.
Go ahead.
Okay, so on page one at the bottom, it says a pager with telephone number listed to Rab was found in the victim's car. Rab is identified as Wilbert Hanna. Fine, we know that already. But he says a pager, not a pager number, a pager with telephone number listed to Rab.
I understand.
There's more, Your Honor. I could just finish my point.
Sure.
On page two, at the bottom, It says, we had to confront Mr. Thomas and reminded him, we paged Mr. Hanna's pager, and he responded, okay. Then on page 3 at the bottom, the page to Mr. Hanna, to which he responded, convinced him, however, that he was going to have to be involved and give us some information. My point is this, there's additional information. This report, the Red Report, was drafted on June 8, 1993. So that was 2 days after the murders and after the crimes. On June 22nd, 1993 is when they confirmed that this pager number was actually registered to Mr. Hanna. So when Detective Lieutenant Red is talking about this number is listed to Rab in a pager, it seems to appear like he's talking about a number listed with the name Rab next to it, so that the victim attributed this number to the victim.
Except that, we all know that this was registered to Hanna, and it's not like Hanna and Thomas don't have a relationship with one another, but the number on the pager was in the victim's pocket. And when that number was called, it was Thomas who responded. Am I correct about that?
That is correct, yes.
And then Thomas, tell me if I'm correct about this as well. Then Thomas calls the police department anonymously, and so does one of his live-in mates, implicating Hanna. Hanna did it anonymously. Am I correct about that?
That is correct. I want to
ask you a question about the summation.
Sure.
Because the prosecutor tells the jury, the prosecutor presumably, let me ask you, does the prosecutor have the Red Report, as far as you know?
Your Honor, in the first PCR evidentiary hearing where all of these attorneys were called to testify was 13 years after the trial. So when she's asked, do you remember the Red Report? She doesn't remember. There's nowhere on the record that she says she remembers it. She just says, in good faith, I've always turned it over. If not, if I receive a supplemental report, I turn it over. The cover sheet for discovery listed all supplemental reports have been provided.
Let's accept that.
Okay.
Doesn't remember. Do you think that a prosecutor who had the Red Report, maybe the prosecutor didn't have the Red Report, but the prosecutor had the Red Report, would have argued to the jury that there is not a scintilla, not a stitch, a bit, an ounce, a piece of evidence that links Moti Thomas to the crime? Do you think that a prosecutor who had that, who was staring at that, would make that argument to the jury?
Your Honor, I don't believe that Thomas answering a page, I don't know what the thought process was of the prosecutor at the time.
Prosecutor may not have had it.
If she didn't have it, then she would have.
And if the prosecutor didn't have it, the defense attorney didn't have it.
But Your Honor, in just
why wouldn't the prosecutor say there's no scintilla of evidence? All it was a phone number connecting Thomas to a phone number. We all have phone numbers. For all we know, it could have been Justice Albin or my cell phone number on it. That doesn't mean I don't know why. There was no evidence beyond that. So why wouldn't the prosecutor have made that argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's why
not a scintilla of evidence.
Even the
not to me, Justice Albin.
If I may, even the defense attorney on the 2009 evidentiary hearing, he reads the report and he's asked, don't you think that this report would have linked Thomas to the victims? And he says, no, it may link him to a drug deal.
So I just want to get your clear answer on this. And you can, are you telling us that a pager number, okay, on the body of the victim, that is called and that is responded to by Thomas is not even a scintilla of evidence linking Thomas to the crime?
Your Honor.
Is that what you're arguing to us?
I understand what the court's position is.
No, I'm asking you a question.
I understand. I'm trying to answer your question, Your Honor. If I may, when you put together all of the other evidence, June 4th is when Mr. Hanna registered that pager number. 2 days before the murders, And then sometime between the 4th and the 6th, he gave it to Thomas. How do we know when the victim wrote down this pager number, if he attributed that pager number to Hannah? And when Hannah calls, when Rab calls the victim before they leave to Jersey City, the relative testified. She testified that the relative, the one of the victims was like, no, you know, I don't want to hear from anyone else.
Okay, I asked you a simple question.
I understand, Your Honor, but
I don't know if you if you can't answer it, tell me you can't. If you, is that not a scintilla of evidence? You can say yes, no, or
I don't think it's a scintilla of evidence, and that's why the prosecutor may have argued it in that fashion, Your Honor.
And didn't defense, you suggested you read a portion of the transcript that I don't remember of the PCR, defense counsel said he didn't think it linked Thomas to the murders?
That's correct. The 2009 hearing, it's on page 29 or 30 of that transcript. He says he does not believe what, after he's confronted with it, reads it, says, no, I don't think that, I'll read the exact language. Page 31 of the 2009 hearing, evidentiary hearing. And you testified earlier that if there was some evidence linking that person to the crime, you would have, I never said that there was some evidence linking that person to a crime. I said that one of the things of the tactics we took was to attempt to deflect attention to Big Moti. Had there been evidence that Moti committed the crime, as I said earlier, I would have gone directly to the prosecutor and I would have insisted that the prosecutor take action on that evidence. Trial counsel then reads the red report to himself and he's asked if he thinks that it links Moti to the crime scene, it may link him to a drug trade. That is his response. And it continues, there's a back and forth between them. They also ask him, would it have been helpful for the jury to have heard this information, for the jury to have heard this person's number was found in the victim, at the crime scene? It might not.
Is this the trial attorney who's on the stand?
That is the trial attorney.
Yeah, well, do you think that the trial attorney on the stand at a PCR wants to throw up and say, hey, yeah, I was really ineffective. I really messed up this case. That's not typically what's going to occur.
Well, Your Honor, his gut reaction, he didn't remember a lot of the trial strategy and a lot of the details of the trial. He didn't recall if his client had testified or if Mary Jones's testimony had actually come in, because it had been 13 years at that first evidentiary hearing. However, when he reads the full report, his gut reaction is, I don't believe that this is literally one line that says, this person answered a page to a number that was found on the victim. Okay, they have multiple numbers that also link Mr. Hannah to the victims on his body in the same piece of paper.
Did the trial court make a credibility finding about trial? Did the PCR court make a credibility finding about trial counsel's testimony at the PCR hearing?
That he didn't. The finding was he didn't recall much of what went on at trial. Are you speaking about
the? Did he make a credibility finding when he made his conclusions? Did the PCR judge make any comments about trial counsel's credibility? You know, at the end of the case, you just say, I believe this person, I believe that person.
From my recollection, Your Honor, there's been so many PCR hearings, but on this one, on the 2009 evidentiary hearing, my understanding is that the court noted he didn't remember a lot of it and his recollection had to be refreshed many times. And he had to read a lot of the reports to himself in order to answer the questions. But that, I believe they found him credible.
Please go on with your argument.
Sure. So under Rule 322.5, since the court addressed this issue earlier with defense counsel, the state's position is that this should be time barred. This issue of ineffective assistance of counsel should be time barred because the defendant has to show under the rule that an error or violation played a role in the determination of guilt. And that's under State versus Lorick and State versus Nash. And the defendant has not made that showing that he was denied a fair proceeding below on this issue. There was a full evidentiary hearing before Judge Isabella. He wrote an opinion, and he had an opportunity to observe all the witnesses and made a ruling and a finding about that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel at that time. And then it was appealed to the appellate division, and the appellate division made their decision as well to affirm that decision. So in order to prove that an error or violation would have, played a role in the termination of guilt, the defendant would have to show that basically that the evidence was affected by, that the jury's verdict was affected by the lack of this information. However, as argued in my opening, he cannot make that showing because of all of the different pieces of evidence that came in before the jury that wouldn't negate, even if a third person was involved, would not negate defendant's own culpability as to the robbery, which then led to felony murder charges.
Ms. Martinez, yes. You heard Mr. Burroughs say earlier that had the Red Report been used effectively, his argument, that Jones would have been called to testify and Lieutenant Red would have been called by the defense to testify. What would have happened at trial had that taken place? What would have been established through cross-examination or otherwise?
So he said that Jones would have been called to testify and that
Lieutenant Red.
Well, if Lieutenant Red was called to testify, it would have opened the door on cross-examination by the state to everything. He actually also interviewed Mr. Thomas. So everything that Mr. Thomas said with regard to the defendant recruiting him to participate in the crimes, about defendant admitting that he killed Salazar, about defendant being involved in prior, he called him a stick-up kid, that he had a reputation for robbing people and killing them, shooting them.
Didn't defendant testify and was cross-examined?
Defendant did testify, yes.
Yeah, so I guess you're arguing that the information that would have come out through Lieutenant Red's cross-examination would have been different than what defendant testified to and was cross-examined on?
Lieutenant Red interviewed Thomas. Thomas never testified.
I wasn't sure who you were referring to.
I'm sorry, yes. So Lieutenant Red interviewed
Why would it open it up? Look, the defense attorney could have put Red on the stand and asked him a couple of very simple questions. Were you at the crime scene? Yes. Did you go into the car where the victims' bodies were? Answer, yes. Did you pull from Salazar's shirt pocket a bloody piece of paper? Yes. Did it have a number on it? Yes. Did you call the number? Yes. Who responded to the number? Maurice Thomas. No further questions. Now the cross-examination, this is the way, is limited to the direct examination, correct?
Absolutely.
So how could the defendant have gone wrong by asking those simple questions?
Well, Your Honor, that's fine, but I don't think he could have gone wrong asking those questions, but the prosecutor would have then cross-examined Lieutenant Red on the piece of paper itself, which had, again, a different number on it, that Hazel Forrester testified was a number that victim called frequently for the defendant. It was also on the same piece of paper. Additionally, I believe the state could then have called Mr. Thomas himself in rebuttal, just to talk about when he answered this call from the police. Was this pager number registered to you? Who gave you this pager number?
And then Thomas would have been questioned about his anonymous calls and about all the statements he made to his mother that seemed to implicate him in the crime. So, I mean, there was a strategic reason why the state did not call Thomas to the stand. Would you agree?
Yes, but there was a strategic reason, I believe, that why the defense attorney didn't call Thomas either. that he was available. The court told him he was available. He was ordered from the jail. He was present in court the following day, and neither called him, but had an opportunity to call him.
Assuming that Lieutenant Red was called by the defendant to testify, and trial counsel did not let him, and the prosecutor was not allowed by the trial court to go beyond very limited questions, although I don't know that they're quite as limited as Justice Alvin suggests they might have been. Would there be any reason why the state could not call Lieutenant Red, ask to recall him, call him as their witness at some later time that you can think of? It'd be a discretionary to the trial court, correct?
I think it would be discretionary, Your Honor. I don't see any reason why the state wouldn't have been able to call him, since he did author both the Red reports and he authored, he took the statement from Thomas separately.
And is there any reason to believe that his testimony, even since the state would be able to then cross-examine him, would not go beyond the limited areas of inquiry that Justice Alvin's suggesting? In other words, as you said, what else the piece of paper said, what else it indicated, what other statements were obtained relevant to that pager number, et cetera.
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, would you like to amplify your argument that the third party claim would have crumbled? I think that's what you'd put in the brief.
Sure, Your Honor. So with regard to the third party guilt defense, the state's position is we don't have all of the information as to trial counsel's strategy, because he didn't remember 13 years and then 20 years later when he was interviewed at both in evidentiary hearings. What we do have is part of the record. We have that evidence, the two evidentiary hearings, and then we have what he actually did, which was he didn't call Thomas. He didn't call Red. Thomas, once again, I hate to stress it again, but I think it's important to note that Thomas, look, the defense counsel's main strategy was, let me cross-examine LaQue on his inconsistencies, make sure that the jury knows that he's, not that they believe he's not credible, and then also impeach him with the MEs, cross-examination of the medical examiner, and how he testified about the entry wound on Salazar. And of course, he tried to introduce Mary Jones's testimony, which is not successful. So we don't know his full strategy, but we know some part of it. I think that if he would have called Thomas and introduced and try to use this Red report to cross-examine it or to talk to him about it and get information out of him about to link him to these crimes, that it would have opened the door to all of this other information.
The defendant wasn't going to call. Defendant was claiming that Thomas committed the murder. Right. He was claiming that Thomas set him up. He had no reason to put Thomas on the stand so Thomas could further try to set him up on the stand. That would not have been a logical defense strategy to put on the stand the very person who's trying to bury you.
Well, that's the correct. That is the state's point exactly, that he didn't. That was part of his trial strategy, that he didn't call Thomas because of this.
But that he tried to call Thomas's mother. What an effective witness that woman would have been for the third party defense. The mother of the person he says was setting him up, repeating what she heard her own son say, that I know you're casting it in a different light, but others might view it quite differently as being supportive of the claims that this defendant was making against Thomas and the state blocked it. The state did everything it could to block it by keeping that evidence out and maintaining that it was not relevant. And now we have this dispute over whether or not the Red report, which would have bolstered the relevancy and overcome the state's objection, either wasn't available or resulted in ineffective assistance of counsel, which is, you know, I guess the only other way to look at it. But it is still perplexing that the state stood up in summation and is making this no scintilla of evidence argument. It seems as if at every turn, the state did everything it could to prevent the jury from hearing the evidence that the defense wanted to put in front of it to support its third-party guilt claim. And normally, the approach of a trial court is to be liberal, if you will, for lack of a better term, in allowing the defense a full-throated ability to present third-party guilt. That's not what happened here.
Well, Your Honor, if I can respond.
Please.
Yeah, so on page 59 of Mary Jones's testimony, the court is, the defense counsel and the prosecutor are going back and forth as to why it should be or shouldn't be admitted. The court makes its final decision and says the defense may also call other witnesses to establish independently that a conspiracy existed. And then if the court is satisfied that a conspiracy did exist, between Mr. LeCue and Thomas, the court may well revisit its ruling on the admissibility of Mary Jones's testimony. But on its own, if I just may finish, Your Honor.
Yeah.
On its own, the court didn't believe that there was a separate conspiracy that they could, in order to introduce it under that theory, which the court rejected. Go on.
My question earlier to you relates to the second prong. Of the ineffective assistance of counsel test. Assume that Mary Jones would have been presented as a witness by the defense based on the Red Report, but just accept that for the purposes of the question. How would that have affected the outcome? What would you have done, if anything, to diminish the impact of her testimony?
What would have I have done as I'm sorry, I'm not following. As defense counsel? What would have defense counsel done?
No, the state. The state is arguing.
What would have the state?
Let me finish. The state is arguing that the third party defense would have crumbled. I'm asking you to explain how you would have dismantled Mary Jones' testimony.
Yeah, so calling Thomas could have dismantled her testimony because he would have rebutted her statements. He's the declarant. So if he says, I never made those statements, I was cooperating with police, I was recruited by this defendant to commit these crimes, I turned him down, he went and recruited LeCue, he confessed in front of me, three other people in an apartment at this time when he came into the apartment, I think that would have actually hurt, and it would have hurt the defense, and it would have
But don't you, counsel, don't you agree that his own mother's testimony would have been very strong testimony before the jury with regard to not only what he told her, but what she observed? She observed the counting of the money. She overheard conversations between her son and other individuals. He told her that he was looking to get rid of the defendant because of these prior robberies. You're saying the state would have called Thomas. That would have opened him up to cross-examination on all of that information, and also his own inconsistencies in talking and speaking to the police. When he initially talked to the police, he said he had nothing to do with it. They confronted him with that. He initially said that defendant only told him about the murder, then later adjusted his statement to say, oh, he also told his girlfriend and my girlfriend. So that, I mean, but then you have his mother who, you know, seems like someone who is not an interested party in these murders and this drug dealing, making these observations and giving this testimony with regard to what she observed happening between her son and other individuals in the days following this murder and all these statements that he made. So I'm not sure if the state's argument that the third party defense would have crumbled because Maurice Thomas would have taken the stand and completely refuted his own mother really is very persuasive.
Well, he would have rehabilitated LeCue. LeCue, his credibility was in question. He would have
Thomas's credibility is also in question. Gave many inconsistent statements. Wouldn't you agree?
But Thomas, the jury had the ability to choose what they could, what they believed and what they didn't believe in, could have the ability to see the demeanor of the actual witness testifying, whether they're credible or not. So that's
absolutely, and his own mother testifying that he made all of these statements against his own interests and engaged in all these activities that he, that she observed, would have been pretty significant, wouldn't you agree?
Sure, other than there are parts, a lot of parts of her testimony where she actually is inconsistent herself. She talks about, you know, I believe that he went and met with LaQue and picked up the drugs and the money. Did you see the drugs? No, I didn't see the drugs. Who told you that that he went to go pick up these drugs from LaQue? My other son told me. Are you sure that your other son? No, Maurice told me. Oh, okay. Then how do you know they went to pick up the drugs? My daughter told me. There was a lot of inconsistencies in her statements as well that were not sure that the jury would have found credible, but the court found misleading and confusing. And
that's counsel,
under 401 and 403, they rejected that.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. And this goes to the second prong that the chief was talking about, like, or the third prong, whether or not it's the, whether or not the withheld evidence would have had a likelihood of changing the outcome. It's not what response the state, it's the withheld evidence from what was presented already. That is the test. We don't go into some hypothetical, well, if that came in, what might the state have done? Do you agree? The test is merely whether or not the evidence that should have gotten before the jury and that was denied to the jury would have likely altered the outcome. Is that not the test?
That is the test, Your Honor. And under that test, defendants' arguments fail because the-
Your point in braising that is how it would have most likely turned out, since the whole exercise is one of hypotheticals and what ifs. Your point is that it had one aspect of the evidence come in, there would have been a response to it to put in context whether the issue of whether it would change the outcome. That's what your point is. Am I correct?
That is correct. But also under the test, the evidence that was independent about the robbery, linking the defendant to the robbery, would not have changed the outcome of this case. He was acquitted of the purposeful and knowing murders. So on the robbery itself, this evidence in the red report would not have made a difference. And that is the state's position. It's always been the state's position.
And Ms. Martinez, just to clear it up, if it changes your answer, I was focused on the second prong of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I believe Justice Albin's question was focused on the third prong of the newly discovered evidence. They're similar, but not entirely. The question is, did defense counsel do something or not do something that would have prejudiced his client? Namely, not getting Mary Jones to the stand. And that's why I was asking you to explain what the outcome of her testimony would have been to evaluate prejudice. I don't know if you have a different answer as a result of that, if it was unclear before.
Your Honor, I think, you know, the state's position is the same. Trial counsel did try to have Mary Jones's testimony admitted. He even, in fact, opened to it. He believed that it would come in, but because it didn't come in under, because the court's decision was that it was confusing, misleading, irrelevant, and that it was hearsay, there was not much he could do after that, except for the things that we discussed and that we discussed in our brief and that we discussed previously about calling, perhaps calling another witness to confront the declarant, for instance, Mr. Thomas. But he wasn't, his decision, his strategy, what we believe would not have made a difference in the outcome of the case, because he was successful. He was effective with regard to the first degree murder charges. He was effective in that regard. And because the weight of the evidence here, it wouldn't have made a difference at the end, because there was enough sufficient evidence to support the robbery charge.
Other questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to add, Ms. Martinez?
As the state argued previously, that the defendant's petition for a new trial under either theory, we believe, fails, and he should be denied a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Finkelstein.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner, and may it please the court. Defendant is seeking to obtain a new trial based on testimony that incriminates him. Whether this court analyzes the issue as newly discovered evidence or ineffective assistance, the result should be the same. Defendant is not entitled to a new trial based on testimony that incriminates him, especially where the defendant's third-party guilt defense is consistent with the crimes he was convicted of. It's perfectly consistent with the crimes he was convicted of, robbery and felony murder, for Moti to have been involved and for the jury to believe that Moti was involved. It is a perfectly consistent idea. Defendant is also asking this court to find the testimony admissible under 803 C25. When on direct appeal, the appellate division found the exact same testimony inadmissible under the exact same evidence rule. Defendant's position here is that the argument is different now than on direct appeal. But again, it's the exact same testimony and it's the exact same evidence rule. There is no meaningful difference between now and the direct appeal, and any slight difference should not warrant this court revisiting and reversing a reasonable decision from approximately 25 years ago on direct appeal, where now we are on second PCR. And also, as for the trial judge's decision, there has been a slight misconception about the trial judge's decision. The trial judge never required a direct link between Moti and the crime for the evidence to be admitted, for the testimony to be admitted. The trial judge was responding to argument of counsel that it fit within the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. The trial judge found that that rule did not apply because there was no conspiracy between the co-defendant and Moti. For separate reasons, that rule never could have applied to begin with, but the trial judge still took the analysis and found that there was no conspiracy based on the testimony. There was no conspiracy between Moti and the co-defendant. On direct appeal, that decision would be entitled to deference under the abuse of discretion standard, and even more so now, 25 years later, on second PCR, where the trial judge was, of course, in the best position to weigh the testimony, to assess the witness, and determine whether that satisfied the idea that there was a conspiracy between the co-defendant and Moti. Defendant's newly discovered evidence claim, as discussed at the last oral argument, is plainly inconsistent with this record and the procedural history, where, as the Chief Justice noted, Judge Isabella found no suppression and found that there was defendant failed to show that he did not have the report at the time. So this newly discovered evidence claim was misconceived from the outset because it could have just been based on a Brady claim, but it's also plainly inconsistent with the record and the procedural history. In addition, defendant has not satisfied the second prong of that test. There has not been an argument that I've heard as for why defendant has satisfied that prong of the test.
Mr. Finkelstein, can I ask you a question? Good. It's about a statement that you made a couple of minutes ago. So you have the appellate division opinion before you, right? In this. Do you agree that the appellate division got wrong what a statement against interest is? Do you agree with that? What I'm saying?
Well, I think, are you referring to direct appeal, Your Honor, or to the...
In this case, the appellate division opinion, November 27th, 2019, page 14 of the slip opinion, that the appellate division did not understand what a declaration against interest is.
In that case, the appellate division completely misapplied the last sentence of 803 C25. Everyone agrees.
So when the appellate division was considering Mary Jones's testimony, they didn't even understand that that was a declaration against interest that would be admissible. So the appellate division got that completely wrong, correct?
Well, they misapplied the rule. I'm not sure that they made an error in finding it inadmissible because you already have a direct appeal decision providing the-
I understand, but how could they be judging the Red report with respect to the possible admissibility of Mary Jones's testimony when they don't even know what a declaration against interest is?
Well, that's not my position, Justice Alvin. My position is not, I'm not arguing that the appellate division got it right. They misapplied the last sentence of 803 C25. Everyone agrees about that. The problem, there's several problems. The first, of course, is that this argument was only a footnote in defendant's appellate division brief. So it's certainly not a surprise that the appellate division didn't get it exactly right. When the entire-
You think that's the type of thing that we should be expecting? three members of the appellate division not understanding what a declaration against interest is?
No, of course you're right, Justice Albin. But what I would submit is that it wasn't.
If a court makes an error on one issue, it doesn't taint the court's opinions on other issues, does it? We don't have an appellate principle that states we should disregard everything an intermediate appellate court says because there's an error on one issue, do we?
No, that's exactly correct. And everyone agrees about the error. It's really not the issue before this court anymore at all. The issue is that, again, as stated, defendant is asking this court to revisit and reverse a decision from direct appeal, finding the exact same testimony inadmissible under the exact same evidence rule. And because this is second PCR, that's completely improper under the rules.
So can I ask you a question about the state's theory today and on the day of trial? On the day of trial, during the trial, the state's theory was that Maurice Thomas had nothing to do with this. Not a scintilla of evidence against him, zero. Are you now arguing before the Supreme Court that Maurice Thomas was involved in a conspiracy to commit this murder with defendant?
No.
Okay. Because you were talking about a conspiracy. Who's in this conspiracy?
Well, that was defendant's position at trial. Defendant's position at trial was that there is a conspiracy between the co-defendant and Moti to commit these crimes and then subsequently frame defendant for the crimes. The trial judge did not find that to be true based on the testimony that was presented to him at the time, approximately 25 years ago. And that decision should be entitled to deference on direct appeal and certainly on second PCR. And as stated, the newly discovered evidence claim suffers from several flaws, and that obviously the court did ask for supplemental briefing on a potential ineffective assistance claim. And that argument, any ineffective assistance argument also suffers from flaws, crucial flaws. But we also want to suggest that the court not reach the question because it was previously denied. This court denied review of it previously. It's also inconsistent with the guidance this court provided in ways where the court said it would not consider ineffective assistance sua sponte. It linked probable innocence to doing so. The court said if a defendant is probably innocent, that's when the court will step in and sua sponte consider such an issue. We don't have anything resembling probable innocence here. So it would be inconsistent with the guidance provided in ways for the court. We submit to sua sponte address this argument. But there's also a very strong argument here that defendant doesn't have an ineffective assistance claim based on the piece of paper and Moti's connection to the piece of paper. And this goes to more so to prejudice, but it also goes directly to deficiency. So it's important to understand the argument that defendant wants his attorney to make at this trial. Because respectfully, it does not pass the straight face test. It's inconsistent and it cuts against defendant in an important way. So the argument that defendant wants his attorney to make to the jury is that Moti was involved because the victims had Moti's number. They must have been in contact, therefore Moti must have been involved. That's the inference and the finding defendant wants the jury to make for Moti. But then he wants to turn around and argue that exact same inference shouldn't apply to him. It's the exact same inference because defendant's testimony puts him at the scene of the crime. Defendant acknowledges that he knows everyone there. He knows the victims. He knows the co-defendant. He knows Moti.
He said he's at the scene, but he said, I didn't do it. There was Moti. And there was LeCue, and Moti was outside the car and could have shot the defendant, the Salazar, right in the head, right, just as the coroner said. That's totally consistent with his testimony. He's not pretending he wasn't around there.
My point isn't, of course, the defendant's defense is that he didn't do it. The issue is that he's arguing ineffective assistance of counsel based on the idea that counsel should have used this piece of paper to the jury. The problem is it's objectively unreasonable.
The piece of paper that would have linked Mary Jones' testimony, so it all comes in. All the declarations against interest and the piece of paper with Thomas's number, and he responds. You don't think that's helpful to the defense?
Well, we completely disagree that it all comes in. So if you have the piece of paper, it doesn't change the 803C25 analysis. The trial judge separately found it inadmissible because it's confusing and misleading to the jury. You have that decision on direct appeal. So we completely disagree that it's admissible, the testimony. And the ineffective assistance argument is primarily based on that defense counsel should have used the piece of paper. So you're exactly correct, Justice Alvin. It's based on the idea that it would have led to the admission of the testimony, but defendant has not made that showing. And in addition, just by itself, the piece of paper creates this inference that if you are in contact with the victims, you're a guilty party, where we have unbiased testimony from the victim's relative that it was defendant who set this deal up, that the victims only came to Jersey City on defendant's request. You have defendant's testimony that he's at the scene, that he's Moti's bodyguard. Many aspects of the testimony are corroborated by the police officer who picks defendant up from Florida about defendant placing the phone call. So this inference that defendant wants the jury to make for Moti is exactly the same inference he does not want the jury to make for him. The counsel would have run the risk of losing credibility with the jury. He may have lost significant face with the jury by making this argument. And of course that goes right to prejudice, because this argument undercuts defendant's defense. He's saying to the jury, look, you should find that Moti was involved because he's connected to the victims. Well, that cuts right against defendant. That leads right into the prosecutor's argument that you're there, you know everyone, you know the victims, you know Moti, you know the co-defendant. So why is the jury finding that Moti was involved because he knows the victims? But then the jury is turning around and saying defendant had nothing to do with it, even though he knows the victims, he's there. There's much stronger evidence here against defendant than against Moti. So making this argument would have been inconsistent, and it would have run the risk of losing credibility with the jury. And certainly for prejudice, the analysis is the same under the third prong, where since this testimony actually incriminates defendant, and it's also consistent, the third party guilt defense is consistent with his guilt, it cannot be the basis of a new trial. Testimony that incriminates the defendant cannot serve as the basis for an application for a new trial.
Counsel, you referred earlier to Judge Isabella's finding in his opinion that it was highly unlikely the Red Report was suppressed at trial. Did Judge Nelson make a contrary finding with respect to the Red Report?
So Judge Nelson's finding is a little bit, I don't want to say confusing, but what Judge Nelson says is that defendant testified that he didn't see the report at the time. I don't want to quote the exact language, but I'm not familiar with the exact language. But Judge Nelson says, I accept defendant's testimony. So the closest thing I could think to a contrary finding by Judge Nelson is when he summarizes defendant's testimony as defendant never had this or didn't remember having this piece of paper, the report. And Judge Nelson says, I accept his testimony, which I don't know exactly what that means, but in theory, that could mean a finding that defendant didn't have it at the time. But it's certainly not a clear finding by Judge Nelson.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to close on?
No, thank you. We just asked this court to affirm the judgment below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Burroughs, brief rebuttal.
Just brief. The citation to Judge Nelson is 21T, page 71-7 to 14. And the judge is discussing prong two of the Carter Waves, reasonable diligence. And this is what he actually says. So it must have been discovered after the trial and not discovered by reasonable diligence beforehand. So did the prosecutor actually hand the piece of paper and say, here it is? No. But it was discoverable by reasonable diligence beforehand, at least based on the testimony that I have from Mrs. Saratides and from Mary Jones. It's this point that the appellate division reversed when it found that the record showed there was no way reasonable diligence could have discovered this information. I would just like to say,
Mr. Burroughs, the piece of paper that you just read, the judge's comment about the piece of paper, if you look at that in the context of what the judge is discussing on pages 69 and 70,
yes.
Isn't he referring to an actual piece of paper with a beeper number on it and not the Red Report?
Since you could certainly interpret it that way, but since this whole discussion is not about the bloody piece of paper, which was an exhibit at trial, the only piece of paper for prong two of due diligence is the Red Report. So I take it that he's referring to that. I understand your logic.
I'm just looking at what the judge is actually saying on pages 69 and 70, where he makes multiple references to the piece of paper, but he's not talking about an investigative report. He's talking about a piece of paper with a telephone number on it, a piece of paper found in the victim's car. Your yes. understanding is this is the red report that he's talking about.
You asked if the judge had made a finding. He did make a finding because the next line he says, but it was discoverable, the piece of paper is referring to, by reasonable diligence beforehand. At least based, well, the bloody piece of paper was in trial. There was never any dispute that that wasn't turned over to the defense. So when he says no, but it was discoverable, well, what does that refer to? The only issue in this particular remand was the red report. I agree that there is some ambiguity there, but the ambiguity appears to go both ways. Okay, and he is discussing prong two. I simply am astounded when I hear Annika say that somehow that the defendant would have been harmed by the testimony that Moti had responded to a pager that night, when you have the assistant prosecutor saying there's absolutely no evidence at all that this fellow was involved with these victims of this crime. And the reason why the trial court did not allow Mary Jones in, I'm going to quote exactly from Judge Isabella, DA 118. The trial court found Jones's testimony inadmissible as there was no link between LeCue and Maurice Thomas to establish conspiracy against the petitioner. Well, if he had evidence that the Maurice Thomas was involved with the victims at the very night that they're shot, by the way, the very night of the robbery, given the low bar of allowing third-party guilt defense, that would have been sufficient to allow Mary Jones' testimony. The idea that if Mary Jones had testified, credible witness, by the way, the judge never found her unreliable, and so much of her testimony is confirmed in so many other places in the record, the idea that she would get there, talk about how her son framed, particularly the money exchange, I think the jury would have found that fascinating. The fact that money was being exchanged with LeCue, that the jury would have found, I think, would have undermined LeCue's testimony gravely. So with that, I believe those are the major issues that I would
have. I just have one question.
Sure.
All that testimony by Mary Jones,
yes.
If it's testified to exactly as you just explained,
mm.
certainly implicates her son.
Yes.
In the robbery, in the murder, in everything. I think what the AG was saying was, that doesn't exonerate the defendant. And even his statement that he's going to jackpot Hannah, because that's what he's got to do. He's cooperating with the police. And it certainly takes the focus off of him. That doesn't exonerate Hannah. I think that was the AG's point. How do you refute that?
I would respectfully disagree, because the evidence of robbery is LeCue's testimony. Mary Jones decimates LeCue's testimony. First, she has her son saying he made the arrangements. LeCue said it was Hannah who made all the arrangements. Two, it has LeCue getting money Thomas identifying LeCue as a perfect witness because of his particular idiosyncratic background to testify at the trial. It has Thomas receiving the drugs, the gotta have it, the label. How would Jones know that, for goodness sakes? And that's the very drugs that the victims were selling their drugs on. All throughout, she talks about how the motive of Thomas to frame the defendant, the relationship between LeCue. Remember, the state is presenting that
LeCue I understand.
No relationship with Thomas. No relationship with Thomas.
I understand all that, and I appreciate your opportunity to reiterate every argument you have. I'm just saying what the AG was saying is he testified he was there. He testified he was the informant lookout. We know there's testimony that he was in touch with the testimony that you may disagree with it. There may have been arguments against it, that he was the one who contacted them to get him down from New York.
Right.
And a robbery and a murder takes place.
Correct.
And what's the evidence? The AG's only point was everything Jones is saying, that he was going to make sure that Hannah was the one, or LeCue, Hannah was the one that took the weight to get him off the hook, doesn't exonerate Hannah on the felony murder charge.
I respectfully disagree. LeCue says,
but it's respectful. I understand.
I know.
I don't. You don't have to reiterate everything LeCue
said. My client, Liberty.
You'll agree. LeCue was cross-examined hither and on very effectively by defense counsel. And it doesn't appear the jury gave him a tremendous amount of weight.
But the jury never heard Mary Jones says that Thomas had made the arrangements.
I understand. Look, I'm not here to argue with you. I get your point. You've made it several times. You never have to remake it. I'm just saying, McHugh was heavily cross-examined. His credibility was heavily questioned. That we understand. I'm just saying, the defendant himself testified he was the lookout, the enforcer. He was there. There's other evidence of his relationship contact with the victims.
What is the evidence of the robbery? Being there doesn't mean you're a robber, does it? He's on a corner. We know he's not there in the car.
Hey, look, I'm not here to retry the case. We're not all here to retry. I'm sure there's plenty of arguments. You might be a far better defense attorney. Clearly, Justice Albin is than the defense attorney who was there. But that's not the test.
But the defense attorney's whole defense was destroyed when Mary Jones wasn't allowed to testify.
Okay, I got your point. I heard it several times.
All right. Mr. Burroughs, if you'll let me, I want to come back to the question about what Judge Nelson and Judge Isabella did because of a concern about the whole newly discovered evidence argument. Sure. I've gone back and looked at the few pages before. And if you go back in time, the Aptiv sends the matter back to the hearing that Judge Nelson conducts and says, check about whether the pager was newly discovered evidence.
Correct.
And Judge Nelson very diplomatically says, no, it's not the pager we're talking about. It's the piece of paper, and I'm looking at page 63. The pager they're talking about is the piece of paper with the phone number on it. And then on page 65, the judge very clearly distinguishes between the red report and the piece of paper.
Yes.
Yes, I'll agree to some extent with counsel, and I'm quoting, I need to consider the red report, which was presented today as D1, and the piece of paper, D2.
Yes.
We went over the passage that follows shortly after where the judge is speaking about the piece of paper and what that is. Are you telling us that you interpret the judge who distinguished between the red report and the piece of paper to be reaching a conclusion about the red report on page 71 when he's talking about, quote, the piece of paper?
It's confusing. It is confusing to me because I understand the logic of that. He's talking about the bloody piece of paper. Yes.
All right.
But
do you think, Mr. Burroughs, that in part there was a shorthand that was going on between the court and counsel and maybe even the appellate division? The critical information that needed to be examined was whether or not information from that bloody piece of paper contained in the red report was newly discovered evidence, correct? Okay. I mean, there was definitely a link between the two, but as you point out, everybody knew the piece of paper. The piece of paper had been shared with counsel. It was the fact of the Red Report's acknowledgement that when called, the information on that piece of paper revealed something that was in the Red Report. I understand your problem because I've puzzled over this as well, as has the chief and other members of the court. It is very confusing the way the court and counsel were referring to this, but it's difficult to reach a different conclusion in light of the way in which the series of unfolding information came out between trial court and appellate division as the case bounced around. Do you disagree with that?
No, I agree with you. If you read the transcript, I'm sure you have, there was a lot of confusion between myself and Judge Nelson about the piece of paper and the red report. The judge thought it was the piece of paper. No, it was the information in the red report. And you could see we go back and forth until finally Judge Nelson says, you know what, Mr. Burroughs, you're right. It's the red report. It's the information in the red report I have to
look at. And when Judge Nelson wanted to refer to the red report in that transcript, he calls it the red report, correct? He doesn't call it by some other nickname. He calls it the red report.
I don't remember him always using the word red report. Sometimes it was by the D2 or the D.
But there's no other instance besides the what you're citing where he suddenly casts aside his very precise discussion of the red report and calls it the piece of paper And when we consider that, and also the fact that an actual piece of paper had been the discussion, part of the discussion, respectfully, where is the indication that that section that you're referring to is a ruling on the Red Report? I don't get the leap there.
Well, it's the second part of what he says, where he says it was reasonably discoverable. It, he says. Well, he doesn't use the word Red Report. He doesn't use the word D2.
Yeah, but common sense. What?
Yeah, but
how could it possibly have been?
Justice, if you could let the counsel finish his answer before you break in, please.
We should all do that.
I'm sorry. Shall I go on?
Please.
Yes. It's this phrase, but it was discoverable. Well, what's it? It. What is he referring to? He says, so did the prosecutor hand the piece of paper and say, here it is, based on the justice's referral back to page 69, I understand that argument. But then he says, no, but it was discoverable. Well, the subject here, is it the Red Report or is he referring to the bloody piece of paper? That's
an answer. Why would the judge say it was discoverable, the bloody piece of paper, which had been turned over? Like, why would it be referring to that? And this is the point that Justice Lovecki was making. Like, what else could it refer to? When no one's debating whether or not the bloody piece of paper was turned over. So if he's saying it was discoverable, why would he be referring back to that?
To the bloody piece of paper? He shouldn't be. He wouldn't be. I agree.
Counsel, I started us down this road by asking you, what was the proof of the contrary finding by Judge Nelson? That's what I'm looking for. It sounds like we're engaged in speculation about what the judge might or might not have said, that the word it means one thing in the first sentence and in the follow-up sentence, it means something else. I don't see a contrary finding, a finding that says Judge Isabella was wrong when he said X and I find the opposite. Have I missed something?
No, you haven't. I mean, I remember the last oral argument you asked me, Mr. Burroughs, has any judge made any finding about this piece of paper? At the time, I was thinking about Brady, and this is not a Brady case before Judge Nelson. And when you came up this morning, I thought, well, hold on. I remember Judge Nelson made some comment about this. And so I gave you the citation, and here is a comment.
Thank you. Understood. Any other questions, or Mr. Burroughs, we'll let you go. We thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We will take them out.